Once more unto the breach, dear friend.
Let's close the wall up with our English dead.
And here we are, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, with another exciting episode of The Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jeff and
Jake
McClure.
I think we left some people out there, or at least some fuzzy critters. There's cats and dogs listening, too, I'm sure. I think that's really what the ratings are
from. I don't know that...
Somebody's left the house with the radio on.
The cats would not like it known that they listen. They very pointedly, if you say something to a cat, if you ever
ignore,
notice,
yes.
They very pointedly ignore you. Now, that an ear will move, so
right.
You know they're actually listening, but they don't. They
yes.
really haven't picked
so
up on that.
Basically, we can't acknowledge the fact,
no, that's why.
So it's just ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls.
Yes, the dogs will turn around and look in that direction, but they will, you know, not make a big deal.
I have heard that dogs howl when we speak on the radio.
It's entirely possible.
So I guess like calls to like.
Yes. Yes, that's why we say we like things.
Right.
Yes, anyway.
Yeah, so we should start howling as well.
Well, this is the Personal Wealth Coach. It is the name of our radio program. And we've been doing this for more years than we can remember.
Yes. We don't know how to count very well.
No, it's... You know, we actually should probably revert to Sesame Street, except that the count never goes as high as the number of years that we
have
been here.
I started with you on the radio in 1998.
You did?
So that was, what, 57 years ago?
Something like that. It was in another millennium.
It was.
And another century.
Ages have passed.
Yester-century. And some of the old guys and gals out there might remember, and we return you to the tales of yesteryear.
Yes, we don't.
Do you know where that came from? The Lone Ranger.
Who was that masked man?
You got it. Well, that was at the end of the show.
Yeah.
Anyway, but this, the Personal Wealth Coach is, as I carefully have already pointed out, a radio program. And if you have a lot of trouble figuring that out, then you should listen on because you're probably exactly the person that we're trying to communicate with. But it is also an SEC registered, It's an investment advisory firm in Salado, Texas, registered with the United States Securities and Exchange Commission. You know, they don't like us to say SEC registered. It's just kind of...
Really?
Yeah, because it kind of implies, since the SEC is at the front, that somehow the SEC has, you know, some responsibility for what we do or something.
Okay, then we're registered
with the SEC.
Right.
But we're not an affiliate of the SEC.
The SEC does not... condone our actions, nor does it not condone our actions.
Neither admitting or denying.
Right. This message will self-destruct.
Yes, something like that. Anyway, but today, for the next 2 hours, and today, just for the record, is December 14th. I'm sure something really important happened in history on December 14th, but it's December 14th, 2013, which sounds to me amazingly like a science fiction statement. Anyway, 773-1400 is the telephone number in the area code 254-773-1400 locally. If you are outside of the Loco area, like up in Waco,
you may also reach us toll free at 1-866-597-1400.
That's non-Loco. That's Waco.
Would you like to hear what happened today in history?
What happened today in history?
In 1799, George Washington died. At the age of 67.
Ladies and gentlemen, George Washington died today.
The first man reached the South Pole.
Who was that? Edmundson or Edmund...
Amundsen.
Amundsen. I knew it was something son.
Roald Amundsen.
And I knew it was somebody who was... used to living way up north.
He's
in
Norwegian.
yes. Norwegian, and now he's Southwegian.
It was led by Robert Scott. He just wasn't the first one to get there. I think one of his members of the teams took off.
Ran off in front of them, yes.
1939, the Soviet Union was dropped from the League of Nations. But
that must have been a very interesting event, a sound, as the Soviet Union goes...
There's a... pretty big one here.
What's that?
DNA was synthesized for the first time in 1967 on December 14th. That's a big deal.
Well, now that's not ancient history. That was just the other day.
Israel formally annexed the Golan Heights in 1981.
Okay.
All right.
And recognized by who? Nobody. But they're still there, so. Anything else interesting happen?
Well, Well, this is the anniversary of the Sandy Hook shooting from last year.
Was it today?
It was a year ago.
But I mean the Sandy Hook, but it was today
yes.
a year ago.
Yes, it was. It was December 14th.
Yeah, you know, it was listening to some very interesting commentary about that I thought was really appropriate. It was on NPR. I know that some of the listeners of this station probably think that I got brain rot now from listening to NPR.
They
actually had a very, very well-balanced article on there about it, and they said that despite all the noises and claims that were made about gun control that came out after that, nothing has happened of any significance in gun control, except in Connecticut.
No, there's been some very... I saw an article about it. A very large number of states have passed new gun laws.
Really?
There's only one state that has restricted gun rights in those gun laws.
Most of them have expanded
gun rights.
But this is the point that I liked on there. They came out, one of the people they had who was discussing this pointed out that if you take the gun laws, for instance, in Connecticut that were passed restricting gun ownership and purchasing and everything, and the federal laws, that it would have had this is the point he made, zero of the quote atrocities that have been done with shooting a lot of innocent people over the past several years would have been in the least affected by any of those laws.
Right. Well, the stuff Adam Lanza got a rifle that was grandfathered before Connecticut's already existing assault rifle law
even if it hadn't been grandfathered, his mother, certainly who owned the rifle, certainly had every right to purchase that rifle. I mean, she went all the way down to even having a gun safe.
Yeah.
To store it in.
Yep.
And, you know, it really boils down to that gun control would not solve any of those problems.
That's correct.
And it's one of those connections that is, we make it in so many areas. It's not just there. We make it across the board in so many areas. We want a simple solution to a complex problem.
Right. Well, I got this. I got this one. A question that was given to me actually this morning where I was asked about the most recent shooting that took place in Colorado.
Mm-hmm.
Where it was in a school, and two people were injured, and the shooter killed himself.
Mm-hmm.
And she said to me, how is it that you feel about this? What is it that you think about it? I said, the only reason that they report school shootings is because they're rare. You don't report things that happen all the time. If you think about that for just a moment, we have somewhere between 2,600 and 3,000 people killed on the roads in Texas every year. Every year, they're getting up
and close to 40,000 in the United States.
Well, it's less than that now, but yeah, it's a large number. We're talking about tens of thousands, and we've got if any newspaper pick up the obituaries on any given day, you're going to find people have died in the obituaries, but it's not front page news. If we reported a traffic accident where two people were injured and the person that did was at fault
it was,
died, we wouldn't have room in our newspapers.
And this is one of those things that I've thought about a lot, and that is that when there's a traffic accident and there's fatalities, it is I never can find any published analysis. Why did that accident happen? Oh, it's private. We can't talk about it.
Right. And basically what...
But if somebody kills somebody with a gun...
Yeah, they delve into the... What were they looking at on the internet beforehand?
And a lot of the... By the way, I have done a little bit of digging into a couple of accidents that I was concerned about personally and found out that it's something that could affect me, but it's not published because it's privately... It might embarrass the family or, you know, what happened is the people got a cell phone call because they were able to figure out, looking at the phone records, that the driver of the car
got a cell phone call.
Yep. And it got the call just as they slammed into the back of an 18-wheeler.
Right.
So,
you know, this is something, it sounds, if you're not careful in listening to us, that we're saying gun violence can't be prevented and that we don't really care about it because there are more going on. Really what we're doing, as most people that listen to us will know, we're looking at the numbers as the reality of the event rather than the hype around the numbers.
Mm-hmm.
If you take a moment and you look at, this is a good one. In any given month, now this data is a little bit old, so the number's actually larger than this. In any given month in the United States, how many people do you think die?
A lot.
Over 100,000 people, American citizens, die every month.
Right. We should probably hold a protest.
Right. And now a lot of that is preventable, some of it. Some of it is not preventable.
Do you know what the...
But if as long as we're looking at things that, you know, that this is a big one. This is also the Amber Alerts that go out.
Oh, man.
They are extremely effective at catching the people when an Amber Alert goes out to stop a kidnapping. Uh-huh. But it's also taken the concept of kidnapping and brought it to the front of everyone's mind. And so everyone is aware that kidnapping happens. And every time there's a kidnapping anywhere in the state of Texas.
Or even in California.
Or in California, we hear about it. If you just think about that for a moment, how rare it must be for kidnapping to happen these days.
Yeah, particularly a child.
Because we are so aware of it.
Mm-hmm.
There's no way we could be that aware of it if it happened three a minute. It would just be inundating us with the number of kidnappings. So the fact that we're aware of it is because it's so rare.
You know,
so much information out there.
We get so upset about a kidnapping of a child. But...
for good reason.
When a person is doing something... And I'm probably going to offend somebody here. When a person is doing something that is inherently dangerous and a child gets killed.
Right.
We don't get upset about that.
Well, there's a great psychological experiment that takes place. And basically, it's called the trolley experiment. Those of you that are out there in Radioland can look that up. Google it.
I've been looking for Radioland and haven't been able to find it. I can't see it anywhere.
I don't know where that might be. Okay. All you invisible people in Radioland,
right.
Look up on your invisible Google. And the trolley experiment, basically, it's a thought experiment of you are a trolley driver.
Mm-hmm.
And somebody has tied up, and I actually listened to a talk on it, but I felt like I should expand on the talk because there were a lot of things left out. There are five people tied to the railroad tracks ahead of us. We're driving along. We can hit the switch and alter our course on the track. And when we do that, one person we're pretty sure is going to die because he's standing on the track that we're going to switch to. But there's five people strapped to one track ahead of us that we know if we hit those people, we're going to kill them. So will you hit the switch? Will you switch to the other track and kill the one person instead of the five people? And when people are asked that, in large majorities, and it's different for every case, but the majority, we're talking about 80%+, decide to switch the track to hit the one person instead of the five. But you turn that around and you say, all right, you're standing on a bridge overlooking the same scenario. And because you're a railroad person, you know that the rather rotund person standing beside you on the bridge is just the right weight to stop this trolley if you knock that person off the bridge and onto the track. Will you push the person to prevent the five people from being killed? Vast majority of people say no. So the difference is something very, very clear in our minds, but it's so clear that we don't even know how to explain it.
Mm-hmm.
We are willing to kill one person to save five, as long as it's an indirect thing. Now, here's the next step. If there's a switch that you can hit that drops a trap door under that rotund person, it goes back to that same thing. It's not a push of the person. It's, oh, I'll just hit this switch. And a lot of people will now switch back over to...
killing the rotund person.
Killing the rotund person. So this concept of what is right and what is wrong hinges on so many circumstances. And the media takes advantage of that. They recognize that the decision to go into a school and shoot someone is much more on our minds than the things that we do every day. Getting into a car. Did I have a drink before I got into the car? Oh, I should be fine.
Did I put away my cell phone and turn it to silent so I won't hear it ring?
Right. It's all about intent. People that get in cars do not intend to go out and kill people, but people with guns, they intend to do it. As long as we look at intent as the reason why we focus on an event, we're not saving a lot of people that are getting killed through accidents. Now, we've made a big set of progress there. And I do think that Google is going to save many, many thousands of people every year by driving cars for us. I think Mercedes and BMW are doing the same. Toyota's beginning. So, yeah, the way to prevent accidents is to stop letting people drive.
There's a lot of truth to that. The best science fiction that I read, the one that as I read through it, I don't see anything really weird happening. And as a matter of fact, some of them are so rational and set in the not very far distant future that it's almost like, is this real? Driving in the future very much like horseback riding is today. It's very limited areas.
Right.
You go and pay a fee to actually drive a car around on a road on your own.
This leads me to the next subject and something I really wanted to talk about. And it's pretty cool that you have segued me so nicely. Thank you. You didn't even know what I was going to say.
I obviously was prescient.
The idea of having flying cars. Okay, this is something that's been around. People have been thinking and talking about this since the 1920s.
Right.
If cars are there, well, the next step is flying. Flying cars are too dangerous because if...
There's people driving them.
People are driving them, they're going to fall out of the sky. They're going to have all kinds of issues. We've had autopilot for airplanes for many decades. Going back into the 50s, we had a rudimentary form of autopilot.
That's rude.
Yes, very rude. It's relatively easy to have a computer fly an aircraft, land the aircraft, too.
The news story this week about that.
What I'm coming at here is that it's going to be after we solve a much more complex problem of a car driving itself in traffic.
Right.
That we'll be safe enough to have flying cars
that will
drive themselves.
Right, the problem with the car driving itself in traffic today is in order to fly, it has to be fragile enough that it would get you killed in a traffic accident.
Correct. Yeah, so that the concept
making it
is...
light enough.
Right, the concept is in a traffic environment where cars are just a couple of feet away from you, it is a much more complicated environment for the computer than to have all of that space up, down, and sideways that you can fly through to avoid collisions with. You could multiply the amount of traffic by many thousands and still not be anywhere the complexity that the computer has to go through to drive a car.
And we'd have to have a phenomenally well-controlled air traffic system for them.
Right. But,
and we're going to get there.
We're going to get there on the ground first. We're going to have a traffic system controlled by computers. It will be illegal for us to drive ourselves on the interstate highways because we will be the one danger point for everybody else.
Oh, yeah. I completely agree. And the other thing is we're going to have to really crack down on... like they already have in Europe, on automobile inspections.
Mm-hmm.
Because a significant quantity of the accidents that occur on those interstate highways and kill a lot of people are because somebody is driving with bald tires.
Right.
And they hit a little bit of water. And again, and that's part of what's going on around here in Central Texas
right now.
Have to improve...
What's wrong with bald? I don't know what...
Tires.
Oh, tires.
Tires.
Tires. Gotcha.
Being bald and being really tired, you're dangerous.
Okay, I am bald. And tired.
Okay.
So that puts me I'm a dangerous person.
The thing that I wanted to, you know, when you talk about the autopilots, the problem with that was illustrated this week when the report on I think it was it L.A. or San Francisco, the approach system that told you whether you were above or below the glide slope.
Right.
And American-trained U.S. carriers, U.S.-trained pilots... since that system was out because of construction, they've had a slightly higher incident of go-arounds. In other words, where they got close enough to they got down there and realized this wasn't right.
Right.
However, foreign pilots had multiples of the number of go-arounds, some of them at below 100 feet, when they realized they were too low.
Whoops.
And the National Transportation Safety Board study... suggested that foreign-born pilots, or not foreign-born, but foreign carriers are far more focused on fuel efficiency and so vastly discourage manual control of the aircraft.
Right.
And so when a manual control situation comes up where somebody has to land the aircraft manually,
they don't do it very often.
They are not prepared to do so. That's an interesting little twist to throw in there.
This is part of the reason why we have to get the driving on the ground right first, because the system that we have for air traffic control in the United States, the computers involved there, are using technology from the 1970s. Because it has so many redundancies built into it that it's really hard for it to fully fail. Imagine the those of us that are in this new technological age, the number of times that we've had to update our phone or our computers and then had that update not work.
Every day for me with my iPhone.
So you update the thing and then it crashes.
They update Facebook or they update the iPhone and I cannot figure out what the heck I'm doing.
Well, just think about air traffic control. Okay, this patch that we're about to update, it's been tested. It should be fine. Well, our regulators say, too bad, we're not upgrading. No, nothing's changing. Yeah. We're going to use the same thing. Now, once we have, that's based on a one computer controlling everything.
Mm-hmm.
Once we have what Google's doing, which is a computer in every vehicle, that's looking around at the activities of everybody else, they can start communicating and you can start getting this kind of peer-to-peer system going. You may even have a grand computer or cloud somewhere saying you should or shouldn't do this.
You know, the airlines are already doing that. They have a computer in the aircraft that says, we got a problem here.
So the airlines are taking a step beyond what the safety regulators are doing. The airlines are putting in a computer system that is actually tracking their own. They're not just relying on the airport to say where they are. They're looking around and they're saying, all right, I am too low. They're not just relying on GPS. They've got gyroscopic motion detection.
There is the problem, as happened in the Ariana Airlines crash, where the co-pilot kept telling the pilot, I think you're too low. I really do think you're too low. I think, and he was ignoring him through the entire process because he was more senior. Anyway, you are listening to the Personal Wealth Coach. Telephone numbers in here. We actually
we will talk about the economy.
We really will at some point talk about something.
This does have relationship with what we talk about normally.
The telephone numbers in the 254 area code locally 773-1400, or
you can also reach us toll free at 1-866-597-1400.
And we have some critically important messages from Town Square, and they're about to play, and we'll be back on the other side with more of the Personal Wealth Coach. And we're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach with Jeff and
Jake
McClure. And the telephone number is in here, 773-1400 or
1-866-597-1400.
Anywhere else within the sound of his voice.
Or your voice. Either of our voices.
Okay.
Voices with sounds.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, the Dow Jones Industrial Average. Wait a minute. We got to say this correctly. Had a negative growth of 1.65% this week.
This week, yes.
Yes, well, if the economy has negative growth.
And that's how we measure things in the economic world.
Then I would say that the indices should have negative growth as well, don't you think?
I think negative growth is just such a fascinating concept.
Well, it's kind of like death.
Don't say shrinkage around here.
When you die, it's a negative life.
Sorry, you have reached negative life.
Yes, there it is. And the S&P 500 also down 1.65%. NASDAQ down 1.51%. Barron's 400 down 1.65%. Do we see a pattern emerging here? I think this is a conspiracy and should be investigated by Congress.
What, that the indexes?
They all moved the same amount, approximately.
Well, the NASDAQ moved 0.06% up.
No. Okay. For the week.
For the week, it's different.
Was down 1.51, which is terribly close to 1.65. But the Barron's 400, which should be different from the S&P 500 and from the Dow Jones Industrial 30 Industrials, was down also 1.65%. So we have amazing. These three major large cap indexes down precisely the same percentage.
Do you think it's collusion?
I think it could be.
I think what it is that they are all measuring kind of the same sort of stuff.
Well, then why, for 1 year, is the Dow up 19.95, roughly 20%, the S&P 500 up about 26%, the NASDAQ up 35%, and the Barron's 400 up 37%. So something is wrong here because they shouldn't be matching.
What we're doing here is we're calling to light some of...
geekiness.
Geekiness. See, we have... often we hear people that come into the office and they tell us these reasonings for why they expect the market to go up or down. And they'll say things like, my favorite team won, therefore the market's going to go up. Or when I look at studies of how often the AFL wins the old AFL wins
the AFL
Super Bowl.
CIO wins the Super Bowl?
Wins the Super Bowl, yes.
That's how much we know about sports.
Right. It's silliness.
Well,
sometimes
actually,
randomly numbers will go together. Sometimes they're not random.
I heard a very logical explanation for the old American Football League, National Football League issue and the stock market.
Oh, what's that?
There are, if you look at the number of teams out there that are old NFL teams now and the number that are old AFL teams, since a lot of new teams have come to existence and they fall under the NFL number, the ratio of NFL teams to AFL teams is the same as the ratio of the number of years the market goes up and goes down.
So what you're saying is that the law of averages works here. If you have the same percentages happening in different places, that it might happen that way.
Yeah, it's more but like it's not unlikely that they will be coincident.
Yeah, it's kind of like if you flip two coins, I flip a coin and you flip a coin. What's the likelihood of when you flip a coin, it being tails?
When I flip a coin, with whether I have intent or no intent, it's 50%. You, on the other hand, have a different probability than I do.
That's a different...
So if I flip a coin and it's tails, and then you flip... it all depends on whether you flip before or after I do. If you flip before me, then the... and you decide that you want them to both be the same, the probabilities go up dramatically. If you flip after me, then the probabilities...
what he's saying is that I can control the flip, but I'm trying to do probabilities here. That's not what I was bringing this up for.
No, but you specifically said if you flip a coin and I flip a coin.
Right.
Obviously yours is going to go whichever way you want it to go.
All right. Say you flip a coin and then you flip the same coin again. Okay. You got tails the first time. The second time when you flip the coin, what's the probability that you're going to get tails two times in a row?
50%.
That is correct. We, as humans, though, find that hard to believe. Because if you flip the coin...
Each flip is an independent,
totally
independent
event. If you say, what's the likelihood of getting two tails in a row...
or three.
That's different.
Mm-hmm.
But when you say... when I flipped this coin, the last five times I flipped it, it was tails. When I flipped the coin, what is the percentage chance that it's going to be tails?
50%.
50%. People tend to think, well, it's had its run of tails, so now it's going to have a higher chance of being heads. No, every time you flip that coin, it's 50%. Now, let's take the numbers a little bit different. And we say, all right, say 60% of the teams are NFL... and 60% of and 40% are AFL. Mm-hmm. And 60% of the time the market's up and 40% is down. No, these are not actual real numbers.
You know, people are literally taking them down very carefully to figure out whether or not after the Super Bowl they should invest in the market next year.
So it is more likely, based on numbers, that one league wins over the other. And it's more likely, based on numbers, that the market will be up than down, just based on history.
Yes, and because... I do have a long-term experience that indicates that so.
Right. So if you get a point where those, if you look at history and you start saying, oh, look at that, there's a correlation here. Look at how often it is that when the old NFL league wins the Super Bowl, we have an up year in the market.
Right.
Well, this is my favorite area of conversation where I point out some very
You know, it's
simple things that causation and correlation are not the same thing.
You know, it's another fascinating aspect to this. Any of you who are investors who have been around stock investing for any length of time probably have heard the old thing, sell in May and go away. Because when we look at history, in the majority of the years, the vast majority of the years, were you to sell out of a stock portfolio in May and buy back in at the end of October, beginning of November, you would have a dramatically better performance than if you held it all year. And a lot of people have asked me over the years.
People go, oh, that's a wonderful idea. I should start doing that.
Why don't you do that? But, you know, it's so obvious and it's so clear and it's so absolutely abundantly clear that would work.
Look at the number of times.
The problem is nobody, and I'm literally telling you this because there have been studies looking for it, nobody has ever realized a significant long-term advantage by doing that.
Now, that's because on the rare cases, the years that are not part of the normal averages, you have these huge jumps in the market, this massive return in the market between May and November.
But I'm just saying
that people miss
right
if
now,
they're not in there.
Now, right now, if you back tested it, you actually have over like a 10 or 20 year period, I think it is, you have a significant additional gain by sell in May and go away. The problem is they look back at individual investors or institutional investors, anyone, and there have been a lot of people who've tried this, by the way.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
The studies have yet to find a single person who did as well
as the
by selling and buying data, as the back-tested data indicates they should have done. And this is one of those great conundrums with back-testing, is that you can look at something and say, over this given period of time, had you done this, it's very clear you would have benefited. But then you go back and look to see if anybody actually did it.
And this is the
major nobody, issue. Nobody was able to accomplish the thing that is so obviously easy to do.
It's really easy. It's kind of like Back to the Future, the movies. It's really easy if you know what the future is going to be to do it at the right time and get that perfect scenario. This is part of the reason why when people talk about performance of an asset class or a fund, my first question to the person talking about it is a very simple question in my mind, but it's very shocking to many people. Is that a hypothetical portfolio? Is that a hypothetical return?
Right.
Because a lot of times when people backtest, they say, all we would have to do to make money in the future is look at what was the best way to do it in the past, and we'll just do that again.
Yeah, but it's the only lesson we have to draw from.
Right.
Now, actually, there is a way, by the way, for whatever it's worth, folks, there is a way that
build
has
a
shown,
fake portfolio from the past.
No, anyway. that has been, that backtesting has been shown to be effective. Not by looking for the best, but by looking for the worst. In other words, if you create a hypothetical portfolio and you look at all of the things you could have done to fail and you avoid them, your probability of success goes up into the future. Every study shows the same thing.
Correct.
In other words, if we look back at the past and we examine the past for failure points and what caused the failure, which, by the way, tend to repeat themselves every few years.
We just say, don't do that again. Let's avoid
the failure issue. In other words, find a methodology that has a lower probability of failure in the past and stick with it. And it's kind of like the flu shot. The flu shot will not protect you against a new version of the flu going around.
Right.
It'll just protect you from all the old ones, which lowers your probability of getting influenza by about 80%.
Yeah. It makes sense.
But you have a 20% chance of getting it anyway.
That is exactly right. When the studies show market performance and people build to avoid as many sets of risk environments that existed in the past as is possible, they tend to do really well.
but
when
slowly.
People try to do exactly what was the best thing to do in the past,
they fail.
As far as the best return, they tend to have a horrible return.
And I don't even know why that is. That is because there's a lot of people looking for, that's a technical term, by the way, we use in economics,
a lot. Yes, lot. It's a number that we consider to be so large that we don't even have a Greek letter associated with. We just use the word
and
lot.
It's an infinite variable because lots are different sizes.
I like to also replace the word lot with a number. I just say a number. There are a number of people, because that's easy. You could say one. Zero is a number. So I could say a number of people are watching us right now in this room. And
you could say there's an integer, zero, but that would be too geeky.
Yeah, anyway.
Anyway, but what happens is there's a tremendous number of people who are looking into the past for success formulas to beat the market, to beat their peers.
Correct.
And they find them, and the mere fact that a lot of people, there's that term again, do it, causes it not only to disappear, as the folks in long-term capital management found out, and a lot of other people found out. Not only does, when a lot of people do something that was very successful in the past, not only does the success disappear, it tends to reverse itself and cause losses.
Sometimes it reverses very suddenly.
And
let me,
a couple of years ago.
Let's explain that so that people don't think it's just magic or hokum pokum.
It is.
Well, it's,
you're going to let them in on our secrets.
Oh, yeah. I'm going to let them know that it really is common sense, that people hear it like that and they don't think it's common sense. They just know, well, how it was working before, and now when everybody does it, it doesn't work anymore.
Who is that masked man?
So the idea there, a very simple one, we'll use the dogs of the Tao theory because that's a really easy one to tell.
Mm-hmm.
There's this great concept where people say if you do a back-tested study on the Dow Jones Industrial Average, people have actually made money on this until they publish it. You back-test the study and you say the lowest five stocks in the Dow Jones Industrial Average, if you find the lowest five stocks and you buy them and you hold them for 5 years, you're going to beat the Dow Jones Industrial Average. That's the theory. So these people did this for a number of years, and they back-tested it further. They went further back, and they said, look, it's still consistent. We are still – so they publish it. And a bunch of people go, well, that's an easy thing. I'll do that too. Well, you have to say, why did it work to begin with? And the reason why it worked to begin with is those five stocks had been beat up below the point where they're at fair value, that they've been oversold. Well, now it's published, and a whole bunch of people are sitting out there, and they read this, and they go, this is really easy. I'll just buy the lowest-priced five stocks in the Dow Jones Industrial Average. Well, what happens to a stock price when a lot of people start buying it? It goes up. Well, then the first people that get involved are like, wow, this really works. Look at this. The prices are going up like crazy. I never expected it
but
to be this fast.
But then they suddenly cease to be the dogs of the Dow, and
right.
Now the overpriced stocks.
Now the ones that were not underpriced, the ones that were not the bottom five, are now the bottom five, which means that they had a closer to fair market value already, and a bunch of people get into that.
Well, it gets...
And raise the price of that a little bit, and then...
There is yet another aspect
yes.
to this. And that is a couple of guys called the Motley Fools.
Yeah.
Started a website, wrote books about the dogs of the Dow, and about how if you just invest in the dogs of the Dow and
they
you switch it out.
They have backed way off of that, by the way.
Well, and it worked for a little while, as you said. Uh-huh. And then when it folded and no longer worked, which, by the way, it worked, it had negative growth for a number of years.
Yes.
versus the Dow Jones Industrial Average. And what they did is they redefined the price. In other words, you say the lowest price. It
right.
used to be just the lowest dollar price, and
correct.
They changed it. No, the
no, they're not lowest price or earnings ratio.
Yeah, they went.
But even that doesn't work right. after you've stacked it up enough.
And this is the funny thing. Even though they keep changing the definition,
it's still every time they change the definition, that one stops working.
And it keeps failing.
They keep doing it.
Well, this is what's funny. They're still quoted as authorities.
Yeah.
Motley Fool says, because they were once right. It's kind of like these guys that when the market crashes, whoever most recently published a book
that said
or a publication
the
saying
great
the market,
crash of whatever
right,
year
the market is about to crash suddenly becomes a genius. And this is the funny thing. These guys continue to be quoted as geniuses in the market for decades thereafter,
even though they
have never been right since.
Right.
You know?
They continue to publish books about the great crash of whatever year it is next, and they're wrong on those.
Robert Shiller, professor at Yale University.
Just won a Nobel Prize.
So consistently famous. If you ever follow him, his forecast for the market is always the same. It's going down.
Yeah, that's what he says.
And so every time the market goes down, he was by definition right. And it's the same thing about we were talking about auto accidents versus kidnappings. When the market goes down, it's such a horrifying thing to find somebody who predicted. And you know, you can then turn around and say
he
Robert Shiller
He's predicted all of the crashes.
Major market downturn in the last 20 years.
And it sounds like an expert, except that he's predicted a lot of...
He predicts them every year.
Yeah, he predicted a lot of downturns in the market that never happened, too.
That makes perfect sense. But speaking...
clock is right twice a day.
Speaking of downturns in the market, we have some more commercials to do for Town Square. You are listening to the Personal Wealth
Coach.
Let's
get the phone numbers again, too.
Well, just relax a minute.
I'm stressed out over here. Ah!
You are listening to the Personal Wealth Coach with Jeff and...
Jake.
McClure. And our telephone numbers in here are 773-1400 or...
1-866-597-1400.
You've got about 3 minutes and 30 seconds to relax
right,
and take
I'll
a deep
down.
Breath.
Where's
and
the
we'll
caffeine?
Be back
Where's
on
the
other
caffeine?
Side.
When our doctor...
And we're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach with Jeff and
Jake
McClure. And I wanted to spend a few minutes answering a question that was emailed into us, if I could.
Oh, yes. We had an email sent in through our website.
Yes.
We get a lot of good ideas from emails that we get, but this one was one we've talked about before, but it's a lot of fun to talk about now.
Yeah. The question really had to do with the... quantitative easing, as it's called, the Federal Reserve buying bonds on the open market, which is what the Federal Reserve Open Market Committee, FROMC, yes, which is the one that puts out all those statements. That's the one that meets and issues the statements is the Federal Reserve Open Market Committee.
Otherwise known as FOMC.
And they go out, they buy bonds or don't buy bonds on the open market, as the case may be. And they have been buying about $85 billion a month worth of bonds on the open market for some time now.
Mm-hmm.
And the person who wrote us had a very, very good question. And the question was about what is the relationship between quantitative easing and deflation. And by the way...
Deflation.
Deflation.
Yeah.
We are seeing right now... something probably that equates to true deflation. The producer price index for the third month in a row has fallen, and it has fallen. It's falling at a pretty high rate of speed relative to where we've seen it in history, which is frankly a little bit scary. It's one of those things that you're not going to hear a lot of people yelling and screaming about, but is still an awkward thing to say the least. And that is that the federal market, the prices are falling out there. And when producer prices fall, ultimately it filters back into consumer prices. And Jake and I have been talking about for more than 3 months that we are observing
several years
that overall consumer prices are falling. You either get more for the same amount of money or you get the same amount for a lower amount of money. Now, a lot of places, there's attempts to get around that, and people have talked to me about the fact that there's fewer toilet paper squares in a toilet paper roll. So,
right.
But there's other Sometimes toilet paper rolls.
Dog food has got a smaller bag for the same price.
Well, you can see that, but you can also see, and I went and looked for that after the guy mentioned it,
right.
There are much bigger rolls of toilet paper that won't even fit in the holder now
right.
for the same price as toilet paper used to be.
Yeah.
Which is another form of deflation.
Anyway, it's easy to see in electronics. It's easy to see in automobiles. It's easy to see in refrigerators and in washing machines. And basically, you go through most of the large expenses, including houses, and you see the prices have come down.
And the question that the listener wrote in was, if quantitative easing is lowering interest rates on bonds, is this action considered deflationary? Now, by conventional economic theory, it's not, because lower interest rates theoretically
cause more loans to go out,
which causes more money to be created, which means that the Fed can eventually back off sticking money into the system because money will be created by the regular banks.
However,
it didn't work this time.
This time, people are the Fed's going and giving them the money to pay off a bond. And the person, for instance, this is just a really great example. If you have a loan at a bank and you go and you pay that loan off, You're great. You don't have that debt anymore. But what if the bank doesn't loan the money out again? That's the thing. The money's out of the system now.
It really comes down to something very, very simple. Whenever you see the efficient market hypothesis, note that it ends with hypothesis because it never rose to theory because it's been proved wrong so many cases.
Is that how it's pronounced? It's not hypothesis?
It could be.
Oh, hypothesis.
But the point here is that economic theory assumes people will act rationally.
Yep.
In a lower interest rate environment, they should borrow money rather than pay off their debts. Yet, that ain't the way we work.
Most people right now have just been through a really nasty debt environment, and they just want to get it all paid off, and they're not really interested in going out and getting a lot of new loans.
And I will remember when housing, if you could get a 10% mortgage, you felt like you were doing really, really well, and people were getting all the mortgage they could afford, and they were busy running up their mortgages and would never dream of paying a house off with cash. Now that interest rates on mortgages are at record lows,
we're going, let's pay our house off early.
The number of people that I know of that are our clients who are busy paying off their houses is astonishing.
They want to get out of debt because they realize how bad debt can be.
They've seen people be destroyed
by their debt.
The assumptions of the classic economic school that people will always behave rationally in economics are, to put it in a very technical term, wrong.
Which is why behavioral economics comes in. And this is, we've got a very short period, but we can look at the jail complex that was being built, and the interest rates were really low, and the voters said, no, we don't want more debt. Anyway, we're out of time for this hour. If you would like to contact us off the air, we have voicemail waiting in Salado, Texas, locally at
947-1111. That's a hard number to remember. 947-1111.
You can also reach the same voicemail toll-free at 1-800-914-7526. That's 800-914-PLAN. If you have something you'd like us to talk about on the radio or just have a question for us, that's where you can get a hold of us. You can also reach our webpage, thepersonalwealthcoach.com or tpwc.com, and listen to podcasts or send us an email. Until next hour.
This has been the Personal Wealth Coach.
It's not just a word on your Fox News station. News Radio 1400 KTEM AM, Temple, Belton, Killeen, Fort Hood.